Hello and welcome to the EMG Health Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Jonathan Sakia, and today I'm delighted to welcome Dr. Malaz Bustani, who I recently met and had a fascinating conversation with. And I simply had to invite him onto the podcast. And I think, in fact, I'm sure you'll feel the same at the end of our chat today. Malaz was born in northeast Syria and attended medical school in Damascus, leaving for the United States at 23 years of age. He then completed his residency in internal medicine at the Mount Sinai Medical Center at the Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio. He then did a geriatric medicine fellowship at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill with a contemporaneous master's in public health at the same institution. He served as an investigator at Indiana's Regenstrief Institute. I hope I pronounced that correctly. He's a professor of medicine at the esteemed Indiana University in Indianapolis, which I've had the privilege of visiting, and as the Richard M. Fairbanks Endowed Chair in Aging Research. One might characterize Dr. Bustani as a geriatrician, a neuroscientist, and an implementation scientist, but I think that's to pigeonhole this rather splendid chap, because that does him a disservice. He is so much more than his title suggests. In fact, with grants totaling in excess of $100 million, yeah, I'm going to say that again, $100 million of grants, his resume is packed full of over 180 peer-reviewed publications. He's written countless book chapters, books, and other scholarly works, and he's received numerous honors for his work and for his teaching. Malaz has served the Cochrane Collaboration for their Dementia and Cognitive Improvement Group, as deputy editor of Geriatrics, president of the American Delirium Society, and supports his institutions, community, and profession in multitude of ways. Dr. Malaz Bustani, I'm breathless. Welcome to the EMG Health Podcast.
Thank you so much, Dr. Sakia. This is really an honor for me to be with you. I don't know if you remember, but I met you in the past and I was looking up to you. You were, for me, a rebel, an innovator, an amazing doctor who wants to make a huge impact on the world. So it's an honor to be with you.
You're very sweet. The honor's mine, but please call me Jonathan and we'll stick with first name. So first of all, Malaz, you're an emigre to the United States. And, you know, recent times have not been kind to people who come from somewhere else and sound different to other people. Tell us about the cultural shifts moving to America from Syria. As you know, I lived in America for many years. And as a, you know, English was my first language. And my late dad had this great expression that anyone who speaks English with an accent, Jonathan, he would say, means they speak one more language than you do. So treat them with respect. Tell us about your experiences.
Yeah, so far, my experience has been really, really amazing. If you compare it to my experience from where I came from Syria. So in my birth country, I couldn't be myself. I was considered a rebel. I did not fit the social norm and even the political norm and the religious norm in my country. So when I came to this country in 1994 to the United States and the United States became my home, that was a huge improvement. I didn't have to worry politically about saying what I want to say. I felt freed and accepted. However, over time, obviously, you know, you go from one place to another. People make a lot of assumption about you. So my brown color and my accent always made people think of me as coming over from Mexico or Hispanic, and I have to correct it. My accent in the beginning made people think that I might not able to understand them very well. And that's very rare. But ironically, the United States so far has been a very accepted culture for me where I came from. And even when I went from Ohio, Illinois, North Carolina, and now back into Indiana. But obviously, my own experience is different than other experience. I became a doctor. you know, and I'm a scientist. So the social norm where I practice, where I do my research, is accepting to have somebody with an accent. But overall, I felt okay. Around 9/11, I was a little bit nervous, given what happened, and that a lot of the hijacker were Muslim, and people look at me as a potentially a Muslim. So I was worried. I had to be careful, and I did not disclose my home origin. But that still, for me personally, did not lead to any problem. So far it's been okay. Now the last 4 or 5 years, things change. For whatever reason, certain segments in our society start getting a little bit nervous about the immigration. We want to be looking inward instead of outward. But I think this is going to be just a fluke. And I think United States has been always the land of immigrants. And we had a lot of wave of immigrants before. They faced unacceptance in the beginning, but merged in and built this country. So I'm a very optimistic person.
I have another dear friend who's been a guest on this on the show, Babak Kateb, who is from Iran originally, and very similar experiences, and a more exuberant American you could not hope to meet. And I know, having lived there, can be an amazing country. So I want to ask you a few questions about your current roles. Because your CV is a piece of work, my friend. So tell us first about the work that the Regenstrief Institute does and your work there. And also, you founded and led the Eskenazi Health Enterprise. Please describe those two things and what your work involves.
Yeah, so let me tell you first about the Regenstrief Institute. It's simply an honor to be with the Regenstrief Institute. I've been there since 2002, so it's kind of very close to 20 years next year. And the Regenstrief Institute is one of the first two institutes that actually integrated medical informatics or computer science into the delivery of healthcare. They have built the first computerized decision support in the early 70s, and they actually had a great collaboration with a safety net healthcare system in Indianapolis called Eskenazi Health. And since 1980, the Eskenazi Health with the Regenstrief Institute have been able to have an electronic medical record, 1980s, and computerized decision support, 1980s. And then in the 1990s, they were able to actually build the first health information exchange in the entire a country, and they demonstrated the benefits in improving the safety and the quality of healthcare delivery by integrating insight from computer science and informatics. So in a nutshell, Regenstrief Institute is the mecca of medical informatics, and there's a pioneer in that field. Clem McDonald is an amazing person. I had the luxury of him being my professor when I came to Indiana and did my fellowship in medical informatics or in the beginning. And he's the godfather of medical informatics. And then Mark Overhage, who created the first health information exchange with Clem. And now there's a lot of other pioneer, Paul Biontich, who took our electronic medical record system, used to call RMRS, from Indianapolis and made it using open source as the open medical record for more than 200 countries, starting in Africa and across. So amazing pioneer in the Regenstrief Institute. We'll continue, keep going now. And right now, my role in the Regenstrief Institute as a scientist, leveraging these insights of informatics and trying to really develop what I call the next generation of computerized decision support, very engaging on-demand computerized decision support to support the quality, safety, and even the generation of knowledge from the healthcare system. And we are now, my group is working on what we call passive digital marker to improve the care of chronic diseases, including Alzheimer's disease and other related dementia. So that's the Regenstrief very lucky to be part of that Regent Street Institute, and you know, hopefully we'll continue integrating and leveraging informatics and computer science. So that's one big thing. The other part of Regent Street Institute's success have been the partnership with Indiana University School of Medicine, bringing over a lot of intellectual capital from the school, and also with our safety net healthcare system called Ashkenazi Hospital that serve a high percentage of citizen of the United of Indiana, and specifically Marion County, who are African Americans, who have no insurance. Some of them have Medicaid, so low social economic status. So Ashkenazi Health has been my clinical laboratory as a scientist. And within Ashkenazi Health, we've been serving a specific vulnerable segment, those patients who are living with Alzheimer's disease and other related dementia, and their informal slash family caregiver. So together with Ashkenazi, we build the Sandra Ashkenazi Center for Brain Care Innovation, where over there we emphasize on developing model of care that doesn't just taking care of somebody living with Alzheimer's disease, but also taking care of their family members. And over the past decade or so, we made sure whatever we discover, whatever model of care we discover, we evaluate, we find out it's working, we made sure it doesn't stay on the bookshelf. So we use science of implementation and diffusion to take that discovery and implement it very quickly into our clinical laboratory and make sure it's available to our constituent as soon as possible.
So I'm going to come on to some futuristic subjects in a second, but there's a great danger in looking forward or being sometimes being too early to market. So some of the things you told me were developed in the 1980s, and I'm imagining what the response was, similar to when someone once told me that you could have a camera in your telephone. I thought, what a bloody stupid idea that is. Why would I want that? So you've got to be clearly a forward thinker and a disruptive thinker. Now, you've mentioned the term implementation. I think I know what it means, but can you detail implementation science to us? Because it pops up literally in your CV. What does it mean to you?
Yeah, so there's two definitions of implementation science. I'll tell you our definition from our school at Indiana University, and then the more traditional, if you can say the word tradition, with implementation science. So let's start with the tradition, which is more accepted. So implementation science is the science of identifying barriers and facilitator of implementing evidence-based solution in the real world. All right. So it's more, think about that as an observational type of science. You observing the experiments of implementing evidence-based solution, looking at barriers and facilitator with the hope of converting that knowledge to tools. Our definition of implementation science, our group, it's more an engineering definition. So it's more of a science that is acting science, an action-oriented science. So our definition is implementation science is the science to develop tools, processes, strategy to select, implement, diffuse, and sustain and scale evidence-based solution in the real world in a way that is locally sensitive to the local environment. So very engineering action science. What's the problem that implementation science is trying to fix is this big inefficiency in our medical discovery to care delivery translation cycle. So I bet you know that it takes on average 17 years from the time you discover an evidence-based solution all the way to make it part of the norm in the society. And that after 17 years, that hit rate or success rate is less than 14%. And after you go through that 17 cycle, and after you get lucky to be one of out of 15 or so to finish the line, the generalizability of that medical discovery, it's very low. It's less than 5%. And for a specific drug where there's a really good distribution channels, there's a good market demand for it, it usually cost that whole process more than $1 billion. So that's the translation cycle problem, and implementation science is trying to fix it by gaining insight from behavioral economics, gaining insight from complexity science, gaining insight from network science to develop these tools, processing strategy to solve the translation cycle. So I hope I explain it, but obviously I can zoom in more.
Well, I think we're going to have an opportunity to see it through the lens of some of the other things we talk about, and it does make sense. Your comment about time to market, I think it could be distilled down to, I don't know if it's O'Toole's corollary to Murphy's Law, that everything takes longer than it takes. And when you sort of look back on why did it take so damn long for something to make it to market, and I think as doctors, I'd love to get your response to this. We constantly are looking for the ultimate answer to every question about every new intervention, instead of asking, to my mind, the key question: does it look like this might be better than what we currently have? And if it does, why don't we bring it to market? Why don't we gather continued real-world evidence and then make a decision? If it turns out it wasn't, we've acted ethically, we've acted openly, because our obligation is to try and deliver better patient care. And if we just prevaricate and pontificate, people suffer in the interim. Am I right or wrong about that?
As usual, Jonathan, you are ahead of the curve. In that mindset, it's a very common agile mindset that I believe it's so important to create much smarter social organization, much agile organization that able to constantly be fit within their local environment. So let me tell you why this issue is, why we are very risk averted, and why we don't make our healthcare delivery environment, a learning environment, lab constantly learning. I believe the reason is for two things. Number one, scientists in general are very, very skeptics, which is really good. We have to be skeptic. As you know, we design an experiment to prove that there's no relationship between two variables that we're trying to find. And if we can't prove there's no relationship, then we can say, oh, I guess maybe there's a relationship. So that's the skeptic, which is very, very important. However, that lead to a lot of risk aversion, and that lead to us dismissing what I call the suffering while we're waiting for a perfect solution. So we become not just risk averted only, we become perfectionist. And by being perfectionist, we dismiss the suffering that happened until we get a perfect solution. And you take these skeptics, this perfectionist together, and you create this discovery to delivery a problem. And then the last thing I want to let you know, I mentor a lot of my colleagues who are becoming amazing scientists. So one thing I told them, and actually disclose that to my patient when I see them, is I am a flip-flopper and proud of it. But I don't flip and flop based on random information. I flip-flop based on relatively more orderly information. So I always disclose to my patients that at this moment, this is what I think or I recommend for you to do. But I can tell you, if there's a new information happen next day or next hour, I'm going to grab it and I'm going to convert it to a story, and I'm going to help you make the right decision later. So this is why I keep saying I can never run for a political position, because I'm not the right persona for that steady, solid dogma based perspective. And I try to also convey to my scientists the same thing. Make sure you are flip-flopper based on data, and do not dismiss the suffering of you looking for the perfect solution.
You're bang on target, because absolutely medicine changes. And if we weren't flip-floppers, we would still treat myocardial infarction with 6 weeks of bed rest. So you've written two, I think it's a perfect segue. You've written two books about agile science and have used that experience to develop the graduate certificate in innovation and implementation science at Indiana University. Tell us what inspired that, and who you're bringing in to do that certificate, because I read about it, but please share that with the listeners.
Yeah, so let me tell you why I start investing and creating and helping in this new emerging agile science, and then why did we create the graduate certificate? I'm a terrible educator, so this was really not a reason for creating graduate certificate. So I developed model of care. Our group developed a model of care for Alzheimer's disease and other related dementia. And I could not make sure and deliver that model of care, which is really, really good. I converted even to a program, a clinical program in Indianapolis, in Eskenazi Health person. But my father-in-law did not get benefit from it. And the reason he did not get benefit from it, because he lived in rural Kentucky, which was around 4 hours away from Indianapolis, and he did not want to leave his local community and come over and taken care of by his son-in-law. So I could not help my father-in-law. In my book, Agile Network, I tell more detail the story of my father-in-law, that as a scientist, as a neuroscientist, and one of the best physician in dementia care and delirium care, I did not stop the suffering of my father-in-law. And now, ironically, my father, who lived in Syria, Jonathan, have Alzheimer's disease and other related dementia, and I couldn't also help him. So I became obsessed about scalability and sustainability. And the medical methodology that I used to discovering signal and noise, epidemiology, and even informatic, are not good, or are, at least for my scenario, were not able to help me figure out the scalability, the sustainability, and the implementation. So I had to go to and discover insight from other science, and that's where agile science came in. Agile science is obsessed about changing the behavior of two things, trying to change the behavior of a human, and trying to change the behavior of social organization or bunch of a human cluster together. Obviously, and before changing the behavior, agile science trying to understand the behavior of both one individual and social organization, trying to predict and forecast their behavior, and then ultimately trying to steer and control or change that behavior. So this is why I went into agile science. I gained insight. And then when I noticed, and I did back of the envelope calculation early in around 2011 and 12, that there will be no way, Jose, I can transform brain health for all for better right now on my own. I mean, I'm just lucky person for sure. But, you know, I'm not like Albert Einstein or a big one or have a huge resources like Elon Musk. So I thought the best way is for me to create a network of passionate, resilient, skeptic, and persevere change agents who maybe share the insight of agile science with me, who I can maybe help them develop tools, process, strategy for the translation cycle. And so how can I do that? I thought, all right, I'm going to do the graduate certificate. I didn't want to make it a master because it's just too long. So I thought, you know, I can really translate that information and knowledge acquisition and do coaching them on how to become an agile change conductor through the graduate certificate. And we launched it in 2015, targeting different disciplines. And we just recruited our seventh cohort, have an amazing 13 scientists and scholar and change agent that I'm trying to, myself and my team, including Dr. Azar, and Dr. O'Brien, we're trying to introduce them to agile science so they can have the soil, the right soil to build their own plan. We share with them our agile methodology. We try to help them to become a great storyteller, a great nudger, help them the importance of them branding themselves so they can get invited to the table so they can make change and work with them. And now we're trying to engineer them into a social network so we can work together and reach a tipping point to start making a huge impact on the hill of transforming healthcare for all.
So when you refer to the Hill, for the non-American listeners, he's talking about that part of Washington, D.C., Capitol Hill, where all the lawmakers sit. Personally, Malaz, I'd love to get this narrative told on this side of the duck pond, because this way of thinking about delivery of healthcare and equalizing access and delivering a more robust continuum makes perfect sense. So I want to change tack a little bit. You told me that you used to be, maybe still are, terrified of death and you wanted to live as long as possible. You explained that you developed a delusion to cope with death or beat it. Tell us about that journey and the concept of reanimation.
Yeah, you know, so I am really terrified. I don't know why, but I am terrified from death. Even when I was a geriatrician, I noticed I'm even more terrified from the journey, the last journey before you die, especially if you lose your brain, like the journey of Alzheimer's disease patients in their last, 6 months of life. It's really tough. So I'm terrified from that. I don't want to die. All right. But I'm a scientist. I'm kind of a skeptic. And that anxiety is it's not really good. So I developed a delusion. At least this delusion does two things. It's helped me cope with that. It's given me hope a little bit. And also it's maybe motivated me to keep fighting the fight and keep improving healthcare. And so this, first of all, I developed one type of delusion. Now I have two type of delusions. So the first delusion was, you know what? Maybe if I can work on a problem that is very complex, very complicated, very wicked problem, and I can solve that problem for a lot of people, and then I will have an impact, scientific impact, and then maybe I will win the Nobel Prize, which I know this is complete shared delusion, complete delusion. But I thought if I win a Nobel Prize, then now this is the delusion become very, very bizarre. So a future civilization might be able to have the technology to bring some dead people back to life using their genetic or whatever. And then they can think about who should we bring back from life, from this human species. And then they somehow will find out about Nobel Prize, and then somehow they'll choose, look, we will bring the Nobel Prize people, and then maybe I will be on that list, and maybe I'll be back to life, and that way I will not die somehow. Cool?
It's a total crack up, and it's yes. Delightful. But let's get a little bit technical here, because as many listeners will know, and as I know you know, there are people who have themselves cryopreserved. Just before or at the point of death, either their whole body or just their head. And people do this. I mean, I know there's companies in California do it. There have been a number of scandals of the, they didn't put enough coins in the electricity meter and they thawed out. Oops. But so the science of reanimation is not there, right? So might it be a reality at some point? Again, I don't want to say never, it's impossible, it's ridiculous, because, the guy who was the president of the Royal Society in the 1800s said man would never travel faster than 100 miles an hour because wouldn't be able to breathe. So, flight will be impossible, this will be impossible, that's impossible. So might it be possible in the foreseeable future?
Well, I think, I don't know about this methodology, because this methodology, I think it's putting so much effort on the biology.
Well, we're going to come to, I know where you're going with this. We'll come on to that in a second, you know, about AI, but stick with the biology for the moment.
Yeah. Assuming the biology was able to maintain the, you know, the structure and the information, then there is that possibility. I think the brain might be the most important one, because right now, if you look anything below the neck, we can transplant everything. We can transplant, we can get you a new kidney, a new heart. We can bring you, make you a mechanical man with hips and everything else. What we haven't been able to do is really how can we transplant your brain? So I think this kind of keeping your brain where it is and freeze it, that might be another way to fix the brain transplant piece. Now, I don't have the expertise of freezing and does it really maintain the connections, the neuronal network connection that's responsible for your conscious and what you are in the brain? That is completely out of my perspective, but you know, it is a good possible thinking.
Well, you know, and you don't want to stop the progress of science. I mean, but you know, you and I also talked about the Johnny Depp movie Transcendence, yeah, where his consciousness is uploaded into a computer after his death. And we hear a lot about AI in healthcare, and some people have warned that rather than being our salvation, it'll be the death of us. What's your position on that? I mean, can you foresee a future where, look, there are now brain-machine interfaces. I've personally worked on one for motor control. Is uploading consciousness or using AI to enhance mental acuity, is that in the palpable future?
Well, I think for me, Jonathan, great question. I think that's a matter of time, at least in my opinion. All right. So I think it's going to happen. It's just a matter of time. But people argue there's two pathways for that. There's one pathway of enhancement through the interface. And I know a lot of our colleagues in Duke and other places in UCSF, University of California, San Francisco, are really working a lot on the interface between the neuron and artificial neuron and enhancing the capability of the brain, our brain function, with technology, with artificial intelligence. As you know, our brain is amazing in pattern recognition, but it's really terrible from storage. We don't store information very well. We store it in bias. A lot of time, noise become a signal. Signal become story. Story become a decision. Decision become mindset. All build on a false signal. So there's a flawed, psychologists call it system one, that work well, but sometimes it create what we call cognitive biases. So I think artificial intelligence and other tactics can be method the same way how state data and scientific method can help us enhance our system two, our thinker, our deep thinker, process information of our brain, and make us leverage both the speed of our system one, but also the rationality of system two. So I think that kind of enhancement of our brain capability, I think it's going to happen. This, we are doing it with eye vision. We're doing it with a lot of things. So that's going to, in my opinion, is just a matter of time. The other piece is whether artificial intelligence on their own become their own species and evolve, and we become the ant. They look up, they look down on us and everything. That is a nightmare for me. I can't rebel it. I can't not accept it, but I hope we will be more of the homo deus, the goddess through enhancement.
A nice little plug there for Harari's book.
Yeah, I love that book. I love that book.
Yeah,
I love it.
You know, there's a great joke. How do you know if someone's read his first book, Sapiens? And the response is simple. They'll tell you. Don't worry. Look, it's a great space. And, you know, you see the work that's being done for motor control. And again, I think what this forces people to do is say, don't be so darn skeptical. Take a step back, because if we're rigid in our thinking, then we limit our imaginations. Let's get a little bit down to earth, though. What's the latest thinking on Alzheimer's? Have you got any good news for us about cause, diagnosis, or treatment? Because I know this is an area of expertise for you.
Yeah, absolutely. So let me start first with diagnoses and screening. I think right now there's a lot of advancement, including our lab, where we are trying to use and develop and implement a very scalable, cheap diagnostic assessment. So for us, for example, we develop a passive digital marker that uses the data that left behind when you interact with the healthcare system. So most people who are 65 and older, they don't visit the healthcare system just once or twice when they became 65 and older. They usually have a track. They usually have a footprint in the healthcare system. And that footprint, it's a combination of structured data and unstructured data, the notes that their doctor and clinician and nurse wrote for them. So we take that data, and then we can see, can we predict and forecast who will develop Alzheimer's disease 1 year horizon, 2 years horizon, and 3 year year horizon. So our algorithm that we developed and published in 2019 and 20 was really good. It's not perfect, obviously, but it's much better than luck. And it doesn't cost that much money. It doesn't cost even time. So nobody will spend time completing a cognitive assessment or reporting. So this is why we call it passive digital marker. And now even we're moving to try to use other passive data set, like your wearable, what you leave behind on your social network, and trying to use that to see if you develop Alzheimer's disease, if you want it, correct? So there's a lot of ethical implication of that piece. So that's, I think, the diagnosing Alzheimer's disease and other related dementia cheaply and widely in a scalable way, it's happening a lot. Then more biologically, we have now, we believe, the scientific community, that Alzheimer's disease, we always thought of it as a big cluster of different pathology. So if we zoom in into just the Alzheimer's pathology, which is marked by a biological marker of amyloid plaques and tau, then now we have imaging and blood biomarker. One will be hopefully available to the market very soon that will confirm that you actually have biological signature of Alzheimer's disease. And then just this past summer or so, the FDA gave accelerating approval based on biological signature only, not on a clinical relevancy, of the first disease-modifying autoimmune method to disease-modifying for Alzheimer's disease. So it might not prevent Alzheimer's disease. It might not completely stop it, but it might slow the neurodegeneration. And there's a lot of new compounds, at least by Lilly and Genentech and I think Eisai, that might be similar. They might be able to reduce the amyloid plaques, and theoretically, they might stop the neurodegeneration. So that's a great, great advances. The last thing I want to tell you, Jonathan, one thing which is really hard, but it's easy, but I don't know if you know this, but the incidence of Alzheimer's disease and other related dementia, at least in the United States, and now multiple research study, have actually declined by somewhere between 10 to 30% over the past two decades.
Why is that?
Because of lifestyle change, because of blood pressure change. So now our blood pressure change, the way we manage diabetes have went down, and there's a lot of what we call a brain health prevention bundle that we're able to reduce the, and obviously high level of education, reduce the incidence of Alzheimer's disease. So it doesn't look very bad.
Well, you know, it's thank you for being optimistic. I appreciate it. So I know that maintaining brain health is an interest of yours, Malaz. So what does current data you've said that it's Alzheimer's seems to be declining. What does current data tell us the best way to achieve brain health is? And in that process, tell us about the company you're involved with, Optochronics.
Yeah, so in the past almost 10 years, there has been multiple clinical trials, at least one major one, that showed if you implement a specific bundle, we call it brain health prevention bundle, then you actually might prevent Alzheimer's disease or at least reduce your incidence of Alzheimer's disease. So what is in this bundle? The good news about this bundle, the knowledge of it, it's easy. The bad news is implementing and changing your behavior based on that knowledge, that's a different story. So let's start with the knowledge. So we know if you do physical exercise, everything is good below the neck. Now, physical exercise, 150 minutes of moderate intensity, once a week, if you could, if you don't have contraindication for, it's also good above the neck. It's also good for your brain health. So that's perfect. The second one, there's this brain exercise that's been going on, a specific type of brain exercise, pattern recognition, psychomotor speed enhancement from, again, randomized controlled trial that showed it may be also keeping your brain healthy. So that's two type of exercise. The third emerging one is social exercise. It's not coming from randomized controlled trial. It's more from observational study. So social activities, which is specific type of brain exercise, we have operationalized it around 2 hours of social activity twice a week with more than two people. And that's also part of the bundle. The fourth element of the bundle is the mind diet. And this is a specific type of diet that is heavy on antioxidants, red wine, Mediterranean type of diet.
Hang on a second. Pause for a second there. You're telling me that drinking red wine's good. You're reaffirming that drinking red wine's good for my brain, yes?
So far, the data look really good.
And for the benefit of listeners, it's important to note that the town of Shiraz is where the wine, the ancient grape came from. It's in Iraq, is it not?
Yeah, it's in Iraq, in the Middle East. You know, everything is in the Middle East,
yeah,
Jonathan.
There you go.
That's where we are.
I've talked about this before, but there's this marvelous study, the Blue Zones, right, which talks about parts of the world that have not only increased lifespan, but increased health span, the period of time that people are healthy for. And if I recall correctly, the unifying things between places like Sardinia, Crete, interestingly, in the California desert, a number of places where people eat a Mediterranean-style diet, they eat lots of fresh fruit and veg, they get their protein mostly from fish, but not exclusively, they drink red wine, they use olive oil, they do meaningful exercise rather than going to the gym, and they have social interaction and a very dense and closely knit social network. So that seems to resonate with what you're saying, right?
Absolutely, Jonathan, absolutely. I think the other two signature, one of them, or other two component, one of them came from our lab, so which is really, really cheap. So we discovered, and other people replicated, and our colleague Chris Fox in the UK has replicated this amazingly, that certain type of prescribed or unprescribed medications that has what we call anticholinergic activity have a very adverse cognitive effect. And now we believe it's a potentially reversible risk factor for developing Alzheimer's disease, close to 10% more risk if you have exposed to these medications. So the problem with these medications, Jonathan, they are very common. So, for example, the Benadryl or the diphenhydramine that people use, at least in the United States, over the counter, and you use it to help you sleep a little bit, to help you for allergy, we discovered that that's an actual risk factor for developing Alzheimer's disease, especially when you don't have the genetic predisposition to it, which is like, freak me out. So that's one piece. The other one, drug that you use for bladder control, you're going to have to figure out bladder or brain, And obviously, drug you use for nausea, drug you use for certain type of pain. So all these anticholinergic, especially definite anticholinergic, are risk factor for Alzheimer's disease. We are doing now two clinical trials, our lab, to see if we stop it, you know, if we were able to convince the providers and able to convince the patient themselves to stop these medication, are we able to actually, with a high level of causal inference, prevent Alzheimer's disease or prevent development of Alzheimer's disease. So we're doing that. So that's the drug. And then very recently, there's not much data around it yet. It's kind of evolving. And that's the mindfulness concept. So if you do 30-minute mindfulness twice a day, it for sure will help you with stress management, but maybe keep your brain as healthy as possible.
Well, these are all amazing things. I'm taking furious notes here. As we seek to wrap up, this is a version of the question that I like to ask every guest. And it's appropriate, really, because the legend of the genie comes from the Middle East, I believe. If you came across a genie while hiking on the Indiana plains and were offered three wishes, what would you wish for?
Yeah, this is very easy. Take me over time for just 1,000 years ahead, not too long, just 1,000 years, so I can see the world, what will happen in 1,000 years from now. Uploaded me, you know, we talk about John Deep movie. I want to be uploaded to much more resilience platform for me. And the third one, keep my brain as healthy as possible. So when you uploaded me, or if you take me to the future, 1,000 years, I don't want to lose my brain. So I want to keep my brain as healthy. I want you to upload me as a tactic, and I want you to give me a chance to see the world 1,000 years from now, so I can double check on all the assumption I made right now and find out how, how terrible my prediction has been.
Well, I have a sneaking suspicion that your predictions will be bang on target. Dr. Malaz Bustami, thanks so much for joining us today, for sharing your fascinating ideas and clear passion for the science of medicine.
Thank you so much, Jonathan. It's an honor to be with you. And what you're doing is amazing. Keep spreading the word, keep spreading innovation, and continue to be a rebel.
Well, I'm planning on having I don't know about the Mediterranean diet tonight, but I'm sure as heck having a glass or two of red wine. So everyone, that's sadly it for today. Please check out the robust library of prior podcasts in the EMG Health Archives or wherever you get your podcasts. And please join me next week for another great conversation. Until then, stay safe, stay well, stay curious. Bye for now.